An integral knowledge then must be a knowledge of the truth of all sides of existence, both separately and in the relation of each to all, and the relation of all to the truth of the spirit. Our present state is an ignorance and a many-sided seeking. It seeks for the truth of all things, but as is evident from the insistence and the variety of the human mind's speculations as to the fundamental truth which explains all others, the reality at the basis of all things, the fundamental truth of things, their basic reality, must be found in some at once fundamental and universal real. It is that which, once discovered, must embrace and explain all. For that being known, all will be known. The fundamental real must necessarily be and contain the truth of all existence, the truth of the individual, the truth of the universe, the truth of all that is beyond the universe. The mind, in seeking for such a reality, and testing each thing from matter upwards to see if that might not be it, has not proceeded on a wrong intuition. All that is necessary is to carry the inquiry to its end and test the highest and ultimate levels of experience. Should I continue?
I think, wait for a moment, let's assess or internalize this paragraph, and then we'll continue. This is the paragraph we ended with last time, and it is good to sort of reconsider this in a sense as summing up all that has gone before, because here he introduces the idea of an integral knowledge. All the previous paragraphs had to do with the various approaches to the truth. And he has pointed out so many different. First, a variety of what might be called subjectivist positions, and then what might be called an objectivist position. And then in all these cases, he has pointed to the fact that there is a truth to each of these. There is an irreducible truth to each of these, in that one finds that there is a point where something is actually realized through each of these seekings, and that other seekings do not reduce, or you cannot reduce any one of them to any of the others. Now, one way of looking for something which explains them all is to consider them as coexistent truths. This is a sort of a hyphenated reality. That is, this and that also, and the other also, etc. And this kind of coexistence of different truths without necessary relation to each other, independent realities, is one of the experiences, or one of the ways in which we can arrive at a comprehensive or inclusive reality in the overmind. Now, here he's talking, however, about relating them. And we can also relate them in a variety of ways, so that they are seen as interdependent. And we can see everything as a very intricate, interdependent reality. So this is the whole idea, and certain philosophies have developed this kind of an interpenetrating and interdependent set of truths that form reality. For example, the whole notion in Sufism of what is called Naqsha, the Naqshbandi sect really looks at reality. Naqsha is really like a map or a kind of a design, and Bandha is a knot. So it's a knotted design, a design that cannot be sort of cut. And so this is the interdependent coexistence of a variety of independent truths. But even there, we have not arrived at integrality. And so, as he says, an integral knowledge must be a knowledge of the truth of all sides of existence, both separately and in the relation of each to all, and the relation of all to the truth of the spirit. In other words, there must be something which each of these is related to, and all of them are related to, which is present in all of them, and that they all find a kind of a root in that. Now, to arrive at that is not easy for us, because already we are constrained within the domain or within the realm of mind, within the kind of concentration of spirit or of consciousness that can be called mind. So that is the nature of the ignorance with a capital I. That's why he says, our present state is an ignorance and a many-sided seeking. Even if it was not a many-sided seeking that arrived at many truths, we would actually not be able to arrive at the one truth. We'd arrive at various truths that pose themselves to be the one truth. See? It seeks for the truth of all things, but as is evident from the insistence in the variety of the human mind's speculations as to the fundamental truth which explains all others, the fundamental truths of things, etc., their basic reality must be found in some at once fundamental and universal real. So the mind itself is not satisfied. It cannot somehow rest. And that is the discontent of mind. That even if it arrives at a notion of interdependence, somewhere in its own sincerity, its own syntax, the final answer, that is that drive for the unitary one that is present within the infinite all. And that cannot be achieved by mind as a coexistence of the one and the many. And that's why that is the point where mind falls short. And yet that is its seeking. That being known, all will be known. That root is present in everything. And therefore, knowing that, one might know everything else. So this is also in keeping with Sri Aurobindo's other great saying, the knowledge which unites is that knowledge, or is the knowledge, he says. In the Gita, in the essays on the Gita. So here also, this is a seeking for something which is present in the various approaches to reality that the mind can sort of can envisage, can confront, can apprehend, and also in something which all these approaches relate to as a kind of source. And then as the source in and by itself. So that's why he says over here, the fundamental truth of things, their basic reality must be found in some at once fundamental and universal real, which is that it is not just a universal real. A universal real would be something which is present in all things, but this has an independent existence which is at the same time present in all things. That's what makes it fundamental. So that which is fundamental and universally real is that which, being known, all will be known. And so he points out that the mind, in seeking for this, has not proceeded on a wrong intuition. But all that is necessary is to carry the inquiry to its end and test the highest and ultimate levels of experience. Levels of experience which we may say will go beyond the mind. So why is it that there is this kind of problem? Of course, part of it is the problem of mind. But there are many other kinds of limitations that human consciousness is bounded by, which make our seeking for knowledge. So I think at this point, he is going to introduce them, and we can proceed to the next paragraph.
So, Devashishda?
Yes.
When he uses the word spirit there, is it really another word for truth, or is it possible to distinguish between the two? And I guess sometimes it can just become a play of words, but if there is, you could let me know that too.
So he uses the term, the phrase, truth of the spirit. Okay. So we may even say that the word spirit is being used as a kind of a polarity with matter, matter and spirit, matter that which is totally objectified, that which is concrete and which can be perceived by us as an object, and spirit, that which is totally evanescent, in other words, that cannot be objectified in that sense, because it is the ground of our experience, our existence, it is the ground of existence itself, it is existence, you may say. So now, when we say truth of the spirit, we mean what is that in spirit which relates to everything, which can be experienced as the root of all things from spirit, because spirit may be that which transcends all things and is that which cannot be actually bound by, just as the Gita says, it's only with a glance of my own, a little portion of myself that I have projected the entire manifestation. So truth of the spirit is that which in the spirit has, you know, gone forth and which can explain all things that are manifest, that exist in experience.
Sure. So he's kind of using it as a catch-all for everything beyond just matter.
No. He's using it not as a catch-all for everything beyond matter, but he's using it as a term for that property of spirit which is in all things including matter, which explains all things including matter.
Cancel that. Yeah, sure, thank you. That makes.
Ron, are you there?
Yes, I'm here now.
Okay. We're hearing a lot of sound.
Yeah, I'll mute my sound in a moment. Can you just tell me what page you're on?
Sorry to be late. 654.
Okay, great. I've got my book here, and I'll just mute my sound now to not disturb the progress. Thank you.
So, Debashisda, this thing about if you know that fundamental truth, then you would know all the rest. So at present, we take it for faith. No, it's like if you know the root, does it mean you will also know about the flower and the leaves of the tree?
Yes, of course. In this case, that is the what he is pointing to. He is pointing to the fact that all these insistences on various kinds of truths ultimately arise because the mind sees that there is something that we can call truth in each of these things. So each one of them is a perspective on truth. So is there, since there are these perspectives on truth, there must be a truth which from which all the perspectives emanate, and therefore that truth explains all other truths. In a very practical sense, you know, this question relates to the experience of the central knowledge of supermind and what it is capable of knowing. It is a knowledge by identity which can be extended to all kinds of knowledge. From that point of view, yes. including knowledge of essence and knowledge of parts of components and knowledge of dynamics between these components. So that is the knowledge, knowing which all knowledge, the root from which leaf, flower, and stem can be known.
Yeah, I suppose we have to be there to really understand it. So otherwise, so long we just take it as faith that there is such a knowledge.
Yes, but the logic that he is trying to develop over the last few pages is that our varied perspectives on truth evolved through various cultures and through the sort of sweep of human history have actually given us this kind of, pointed to this kind of thing that we call truth. That there is a truth that all of them are looking for and that they find in various ways, which gives us all these varieties of realized philosophies, the realizations of philosophies. The truth, we can only say, for example, that the truth exists in all these things. And that's why in the previous paragraph, the implication of what he's saying is that either these truths exist separately, we cannot affirm, if we are to affirm that one of these truths exists but the others don't exist, then we end up with a religious warfare, which has been basically, and I'm using the word religious warfare in a very broad sense, including the warfare between religion and science, for example, which is also a kind of religious warfare. But if we are to take a sincere perspective on the history of human seeking for knowledge, then we'll see that indeed each one of these has a validity, a truth validity. And these truth validities ultimately coexist. So do they coexist independently? And it's just a property of the human mind that makes it a difficulty for us to sort of accept the fact that there is no unitary root, or is there a unitary root? So actually, I think over here, why he is drawing on the intuition of the mind is that mind's intuition for that unitary root is not ill-founded. That intuition is there in the mind because there is such a root, even if mind in and by itself cannot experience or realize that. So that gives the validity to the fact that you may find independent coexisting truth perspectives, you might find hyphenated truth perspectives, you might find codependent truth perspectives, but ultimately that you might or you should be able to look for, seek, and find the truth from which all these other perspectives emerge. That is the fundamental real, as he calls it, rather than the universal real. It is fundamental and universal.
Okay, I understand now. It's a process of going to the root. And then we find that the root is common to all these different branches.
Yes, but the seeking of the branches gives us more and more the intuition of the root. See, this is the thing. Our present state is an ignorance and a many-sided seeking. It seeks for the truth of all things, but as is evident from the insistence and the variety of the human mind speculations, the fundamental truth of things, etc., the fundamental truth of things, their basic unity, must be found in some at once fundamental and universal real. So that they lead us, that this many-sided seeking is what accumulates, in a sense, the intuition of the root.
Yeah, this also means that unless we do the many-sided seeking, there's no chance that this intuition will suddenly plop on us.
That is the comprehensiveness of universal knowledge. But of course, it's also possible that, by grace or whatever, there is a jump directly to the fundamental truth. But this is the way in which truth has invited human endeavor for knowledge through time. And therefore, today, when Sri Aurobindo is giving us this great message, we are, as a human race, at the cusp, you know, at the eschatological cusp, you may say, at the, almost like the end times of the human mind.
Yeah, like you were saying, no, last time that Hegel announced that it was the end of history.
Yes.
Shall we read the next paragraph?
Yes, let us proceed.
Shyam, you want to read? So, Shyam is going to read.
But since it is from the ignorance that we proceed to the knowledge, we have had first to discover the secret nature and full extent of the ignorance. If we look at this ignorance in which ordinarily we live by the very circumstance of our separative existence in a material, in a spatial and temporal universe, we see that on its obscurer side it reduces itself, from whatever direction we look at or approach it, into the fact of a many-sided self-ignorance. We are ignorant of the Absolute, which is the source of all being and becoming. We take partial facts of being, temporal relations of the becoming, for the whole truth of existence. That is the first, the original ignorance. We are ignorant of the spaceless, timeless, immobile and immutable self. We take the constant mobility and mutation of the cosmic becoming in time and space for the whole truth of existence. That is the second, the cosmic ignorance. We are ignorant of our universal self, the cosmic existence, the cosmic consciousness, our infinite unity with all being and becoming. We take our limited egoistic mentality, vitality, corporeality for our true self and regard everything other than that as not self. That is the third, the egoistic ignorance. We are ignorant of our eternal becoming in time. We take this little life in a small span of time, in a petty field of space, for our beginning, our middle, and our end. That is the fourth, the temporal ignorance. Even within this brief temporal becoming, we are ignorant of our large and complex being, of that in us which is superconscient, subconscient, intraconscient, circumconscient to our surface becoming. We take that surface becoming with its small selection of overtly mentalized experiences for our whole existence. That is the fifth, the psychological ignorance. We are ignorant of the true constitution of our becoming. We take the mind or life or body or any two of these or all three for our true principle or the whole account of what we are, losing sight of that which constitutes them and determines by their occult presence, and is meant to determine sovereignly by its emergence in their operations. That is the sixth, the constitutional ignorance. As a result of all these ignorances, we miss the true knowledge, government and enjoyment of our life in the world. We are ignorant in our thought, will, sensations, actions, return wrong or imperfect responses at every point to the questionings of the world. Wander in a maze of errors and desires, strivings and failures, pain and pleasure, sin and stumbling. Follow a crooked road, grope blindly for a changing goal. That is the seventh, the practical ignorance.
This is a very, very loaded paragraph, which actually he introduces in just a single paragraph over here, but he will develop much more later as what he calls the sevenfold ignorance. And he has a whole chapter on from the sevenfold ignorance to the sevenfold knowledge later. But here he lays it out, what is the complete locus, let me see, what are the dimensions of ignorance of our human existence? Just as we may say that, you know, there's the whole story about how in the parading of creatures before the gods, they are asked what is a fitting instrument, a vehicle. Finally, it's only when the human is brought forth that the gods say, truly well created to the creator, because they can house themselves in this creature, the human being. This is another way of saying what the Bible says, that man is created in the image of God. So what that means really is that in potential, the human being is the first of nature's creatures that can actually manifest the experiencing capability of the divine. What Sri Aurobindo calls to know God as God knows himself. And that is really the supramental capability. So here is the potential. But that potential is extremely latent and circumscribed by a variety of forms of ignorance. And here is where he's defining those forms for us. He's defining them in terms of the knowledge. So from the knowledge to the ignorance, we are looking at human existence as a kind of field of varied ignorance from the viewpoint of the truth, of the knowledge. So knowledge to be experienced by us must be approached in all these various ways, because from our divided consciousness, we need to address each one of these forms of ignorance as a form of seeking for knowledge. If we look at it like that, then we can actually see how this knowledge has become these forms of ignorance, or how these forms of ignorance relate themselves to forms of knowledge. And he starts, as is usual with Sri Aurobindo, from top down. So he goes first with the absolute. As he says, if we look at this ignorance in which ordinarily we live by the very circumstance of our separative existence in a material, in a spatial and temporal universe, we see that it, on its obscurer side, it reduces itself from whatever direction we look at or approach it into the fact of a many-sided self-ignorance. So really it becomes a problem of self-knowledge. And as we have seen from the beginning of these chapters, one way of approaching the whole philosophical question of man and God, or of being and becoming, even more fundamentally, is this double questioning from both sides, who am I? A question of self-knowledge. The question of self-knowledge posed by the Supreme Self to itself, and the question of self-knowledge posed by the derivation of that question, which is the becoming, to itself. These two questionings are what one might call the double evolution, which he talks about elsewhere. The double evolution of spirit evolving towards matter and of matter evolving towards spirit infinitely. Because self is infinite. So over here, we find that this self-knowledge, this basic question of self, as a question of knowledge, is what is the root of the finding of this varied or many-sided self-ignorance. So what are these forms of self-ignorance? First is the problem of being ignorant of the absolute. This is the absolute, which is the source of all being and becoming. In other words, that which is truly infinite and truly one. Beyond being and non-being, beyond being and non-being, transcendental in the supreme sense, supremely unmanifest and manifest at the same time. So that absolute, infinite reality or mystery, better to call it mystery than reality, because in itself, it is never going to be fully manifest. There is always to it infinitely more to manifest. That is the first supreme ignorance, because that is the supreme knowledge of which we and all the creatures that proceed from that need to be aware of, or need to have the consciousness of, to possess the root, the absolute root. So that is the first. We are ignorant of the absolute, which is the source of all being and becoming. We take partial facts of life, of being, temporal relations of the being, becoming, for the whole truth of existence. That is the first, the original ignorance. The second form of ignorance comes down from the absolute into the realm of being. And this one might call the Satchidana.
One second. Sorry to interrupt.
Yes.
This is Kika. Yes. Actually, about this original ignorance, is it also possible to say that taking the many as a starting point instead of...
Can you be a little louder? I think we are losing your voice a little bit.
Yes. What I'm saying is that taking the division and this many as the starting point of the reality, can that be said as the original ignorance?
Did you say taking the many as the starting point?
Sort of. What I'm saying is the division. Division. And to take the division and this divided reality as the starting point of the reality. Can that be said as the original ignorance?
Yes, it's the division. So let's see what he says over there about, we take partial facts of being, temporal relations of the becoming, for the whole truth of existence. So here, both the division in terms of being and becoming are standing in the way of the absolute or original ignorance. That is that of being. If we look at being in its various aspects, and in each of these aspects feel that this is the truth, that becomes a limitation upon the being. But also in becoming, to look at becoming in terms of its very temporal relations, that is, for example, we can look at one human life, or we can look at one aeon of human history, or one kalpa, or we can look at how these various kinds of temporalities relate to a static reality. And completely separate from each other. This division, the division of the partiality or the different approaches to being, and the division of different forms of temporality or temporal relations to becoming, this itself is constitutes the original ignorance. So you may say, yes, it is a divisioning, or what one might call the sacrifice of the being, the fragmenting of the being in space and time, which forms the basis of the original ignorance.
Actually, can you also speak about the place of time in the ignorance and in the knowledge?
Yeah, that will automatically come up a little later, but this question of original ignorance, have I answered you? Hello?
Sorry, yes, my microphone was muted. Yes.
So is that what you were saying?
Yes. I was trying to stress on the point that, you know, the starting point, I mean, you know,
yes,
as the only reality or the fundamental reality, taking the division as the fundamental reality.
Yes.
That, yeah. And yes, you answered that.
Okay, yes. Yes. Actually, it's very interesting because over here, when he's talking about our many-sided ignorance, he's looking at the human being also as a kind of a wide field, that some may actually have overcome some of these forms of ignorance, but still we have other forms of ignorance. Like, for example, even spiritually realized beings who, for example, have had realization of Keval Advaita or of Vishishta Advaita, or each one of these forms of the truth of being is still lacking or constrained by this kind of ignorance that we may call the original ignorance. See, or that may have even the realization of some kind of temporal persistence beyond one life may still be, you know, suffering from this original ignorance. The other ignorances we find are even more limited, so they arise from even sort of more denser forms of human ignorance. But this one is a kind of an original ignorance, which even if we overcome many of the others, this remains in a sense.
Yeah, actually the temporal, I mean, that is also a sort of distribution over time, right?
Yes. Exactly.
I was just wondering, so where does he classify the ignorance of not knowing that we are ignorant?
The ignorance of not knowing that you are ignorant?
Yeah, like in this one paragraph, Sri Aurobindo has pointed out 7 kinds of ignorances that we are victim of. But
yes,
before coming to this, I didn't even know that I didn't know.
Yes, of course that is true, but that itself is a form of ignorance. You see, it's a form of ignorance in that we may actually accept our state of ignorance as the truth or as the reality. Now that form of ignorance may contain all these forms of ignorance. We call them a state of ignorance only when we realize that they, you know, have a certain kind of a status as ignorance relative to knowledge or relative to the seeking for knowledge. Now, what you say, not knowing that one is ignorant, yes, many people feel that they are not ignorant because this is human condition. But in some sense, the need to know arises in some way or the other, even if it is an empirical need to know. A need to know the world, a need to know what is around us. And you'd see that, you know, all those kinds of ignorance are also part of this field of ignorance. because he talks about practical ignorance, he talks about constitutional ignorance. Even a very, very objectified practical ignorance is everybody's condition. We are ignorant of our world and we are ignorant of how to deal with our world. So it isn't really that nobody, that there is anybody who feels that they are not ignorant. They may not admit it to themselves, but everybody is seeking for some kind of greater clarity in their lives.
Yeah, only that all the ignorances are clubbed together as some unknown. But here he points out those seven different kinds of ignorances, which is very beautiful. Yeah.
Right. So this division into seven different kinds of ignorances is important from the point of view of a seeking for integral knowledge. Because it's only then that clarity comes. Before that, everything is a kind of a mass of ignorance. It's only when we actually try to approach the integral route from its various different directions that there is a certain kind of clarity about what is the field of ignorance and its constituents. So from that original ignorance, we move on to what one might call ignorance of being, what he calls over here the cosmic ignorance. Here, from the absolute, there is an entry into the field of being. Absolute transcends being. Absolute is being and non-being. Absolute cannot be even constrained by being. So we find over here the second kind of ignorance. We are ignorant of the spaceless, timeless, immobile and immutable self. We take the constant mobility and mutation of the cosmic becoming in time and space for the whole truth of existence. That is the second, the cosmic ignorance. Here the division is between being and becoming. The becoming, which is constantly changing, becoming in which things are going on all the time. But backgrounding this becoming is the being which is changeless, the being which is infinite, eternal, which knows itself as an infinite equable extension. That is not known to us, that status is not known to us. And we've dropped in this form of ignorance to an ignorance closer to our human condition. That is, that of people who haven't had any experience, for example, of any one of these Vedantas, that one might say, you know, the different Vedantas, that to arrive at an experience or a realization of being, whether it is the being separate from the world or the being in the presence of all things in the world, or being within various things in the world, or being in nature, any kind of presence of a eternal and static being as an independent existence, backgrounding the cosmos and being the root of the cosmic becoming. That is the basis of the second kind of ignorance, the cosmic ignorance. But the third one is dropping one step further into the cosmos and seeing that this entire cosmic reality, this cosmic becoming itself, is something which we find ourselves separated from. Our normal experience is that of being monads, monads of consciousness in an unconscious universe. And so here we find we are ignorant of the universal self, the cosmic existence, the cosmic consciousness, our infinite unity with all being and becoming. We take our limited egoistic mentality, vitality, corporeality for our true self and regard everything other than that as not self. This is the third, the egoistic ignorance. This arises from the separation and limitedness of the human individual from the cosmos or the cosmic becoming. Sitaram is going to come. So that is the third ignorance. I think Sitaram is trying to come in. Oh, okay, I think yes.
This Jyoti is okay, trying to call. I'll just tell her that if she calls, I cannot add her to the conference. She has to hang up. Then I'll have to add her.
Okay, then we move on to the fourth ignorance. We are ignorant of our eternal becoming in time. So now the temporality aspect is coming up. We started with the absolute, then we came to being, which is backgrounding the becoming. Then we came to the cosmic becoming with being included within it. Now we are coming to the notion of that which is characterizing the becoming, which is time. So we are entering into the flow of time. The becoming, seen with a capital B, is already an eternity. It's an eternal becoming. It is a perpetuity. To know the becoming as a becoming with a capital B is to also see it in terms of an eternity of becoming. But once we drop into the river of becoming, we can only experience it in terms of various temporalities, various extents of time. And here, as he says over there, our experience in the eternal becoming of time is our little span of time. We take this little life in a small span of time, in a petty field of space, for our beginning, our middle, and our end. This is the fourth, the temporal existence. So this is our division inside the body of time, oneness, as one existence. There may be an expansion of this in the fact that one may say that death does not finish our lives, that we move on from one life to another. But even within that, this idea of a death is a symbol of some kind of a discrete ending point to a beginning. Birth and death are the margins of a sense of discreteness. Yes, it's a temporal ignorance. This gives us the basis of a temporal ignorance. So within this brief temporal becoming, we are ignorant of our large and complex being. So in any case, this becomes the basis of the temporal ignorance. So then we are coming down closer and closer to our constrained human life with the sort of, you know, state of understanding that we accept as our limitedness, beyond which we cannot see. So even within that, within one lifetime, one may say, even within this brief temporal becoming, we are ignorant of our large and complex being. So within that, again, there's this sense of a who are we, which does not take in the cosmic existence which is at work within the span of one life. Of that in us which is superconscient, subconscient, intraconscient, circumconscient to our surface becoming, we take that surface becoming with its small selection of overtly mentalized experiences for our whole existence. That is the fifth, the psychological ignorance. In other words, our own knowledge of who we are as the field of our own consciousness. What is the field of consciousness that constitutes us as a self? That is constrained to just a surface movement. That is the fifth, the psychological ignorance. Then we move on. We are ignorant of the true constitution of our becoming. So this is, you know, it's the whole thing is almost like a kind of a flip-flop from one reality to a smaller reality. We move from the absolute to the truth of being. We move from the truth of being to the truth of cosmos. We move from the truth of cosmos to the truth of becoming. Move from the truth of becoming to the truth of the existence of reality within the becoming, of cosmos within becoming. We move from the cosmos within becoming to a temporality within that cosmos. So becoming within the constraints of this limited being. And that's the sixth one. The ignorance of the true constitution of our becoming. In other words, what in us is becoming? We take the mind or life or body or any two of these or all three for our true principle or the whole account of what we are, losing sight of that which constitutes them and determines by its occult presence and is meant to determine sovereignly by its emergence their operations. That is the sixth, the constitutional ignorance. In other words, there is a root to the becoming. There is a purusha, there is a person that is becoming in each of us. And that person, we may say, from one point of view is the Jivatman, and from another point of view is the psychic being that is actually present in the other forms of becoming within us, the mental becoming, the vital becoming, the physical becoming, integrally present, integrating them as one person. So the lack of knowledge of that is the constitutional ignorance. As a result of all these ignorances, we miss the true knowledge, government, and enjoyment of our life in the world. And this is our normal condition. This is a condition, or this is a form of ignorance which nobody can deny. They can deny all the others. They may have no place for all the others in their life. But not one human being can deny the fact that we miss the true knowledge, government, and enjoyment of our life in the world, because life of human beings is a discontented suffering. We are ignorant in our thought, will, sensations, actions, return wrong or imperfect responses at every point to the questionings of the world, wander in a maze of errors and desires, strivings and failures, pain and pleasure, sin and stumbling, follow a crooked road, grope blindly for a changing goal. That is the seventh, the practical ignorance. So from the viewpoint of our ordinary humanity, we may say it is this seventh form of ignorance which is most concrete to us. That in fact gives reality to all other forms of ignorance. But from the viewpoint of truth, we may see that there is a whole hierarchy of forms of ignorance, each one containing the next. And that is how Sri Aurobindo leaves it out.
And Debashishta?
Yes.
So, although the last one is the most apparent or the most external form of ignorance, tackling all these ignorances should start in the order that he has described, right? From the most fundamental or the highest and the deepest to the most exterior.
Not really tackling of these ignorances has to start from the first, because that first is so far from us. But no true solution to the last can be found until we find the first. This is, in a sense, the reason why this order is so important. That why are we seeking for knowledge? We are not seeking for knowledge just because it's a kind of pastime, nor is it because we would like to arrive at knowledge as a sort of imperative of knowledge, but ultimately because we want to solve the practical problem, the problem of practical ignorance. Ultimately, it boils down to that. that in the manifestation as children of the earth, as mortal beings, as beings who are constantly harried by life, we want to find a solution to our existence in the world. And we may approach it from a variety of directions, but there is no real solution until we actually arrive at the answer to the seven forms of ignorance that circumscribe us.
Yeah, this was a very beautiful paragraph. I mean, it was really illuminating and so different from the previous ones.
It, actually, in a sense, he is coming to almost like a culmination, and this is one of the things about the Life Divine and Sri Aurobindo's writing also in general, that the paragraphs are not of the same density, that he builds something up and then all of a sudden he actually gives in a small paragraph perhaps so much powerful substance, such condensed substance, that you know it'll take the rest of the book perhaps to develop that. But this is also his methodology, which is a spiral methodology, which is the methodology of education that Sri Aurobindo espouses, which is that we learn first by receiving the whole in a small packet, and then we spend the rest of our lives actually understanding it, in a sense.
Yeah, he is raising English to the standard of Mahavakya.
Yes, no doubt.
Shall we read the next one? Shall I read it, Debashita, next one?
Sure, go ahead. I think this paragraph is so powerful and dense that it needs contemplation, and so we should finish this chapter. But I'm just making a call for all of us to really contemplate this through the week as really a kind of a meditation for the rest of the study.
Sure, we'll do that. Our conception of the ignorance will necessarily determine our conception of the knowledge, and determine therefore, since our life is the ignorance at once denying and seeking after the knowledge, the goal of human effort and the aim of the cosmic endeavor. Integral knowledge will then mean the cancelling of the sevenfold ignorance by the discovery of what it misses and ignores, a sevenfold self-revelation within our consciousness. It will mean the knowledge of the Absolute as the origin of all things, the knowledge of the Self, the Spirit, the Being, and of the Cosmos as the Self's becoming, the becoming of the Being, a manifestation of the Spirit. The knowledge of the world as one with us in the consciousness of our true Self, thus cancelling our division from it by the separative idea and life of ego. The knowledge of our psychic entity and its immortal persistence in time beyond death and earth existence. the knowledge of our greater and inner existence behind the surface, the knowledge of our mind, life and body in its true relation to the self within and the superconscient spiritual and supramental being above them, the knowledge finally of the true harmony and true use of our thought, will and action, and a change of all our nature into a conscious expression of the truth of the spirit, the self, the divinity, the integral spiritual reality.
So again, in an absolute nutshell, he is laying out over here the sevenfold knowledge, as he is going to call it elsewhere. These are the seven forms of knowledge that are self-revelation, as he says here, revelation of the self to the self, by which these seven forms of ignorance can be overcome. And he, in a very succinct manner, is giving the kind of interdependence of each and of the relation between the form of knowledge and the form of ignorance which corresponds to it. So he starts with the knowledge of the absolute as the origin of all things. So that is the, it overcomes the original ignorance. Then he goes on to the knowledge of the being, of the self, the spirit, the being, and the cosmos as the self's becoming. So it is seeing, for example, the projection of the Vyakta Paratpara as the Satchidananda, as the being, as the Paramatma, as the self, as the spirit, okay, which then projects from itself the becoming. Okay, so that, and the being, and of the cosmos as the self's becoming, its own becoming. The becoming of the being, a manifestation of the spirit. So that is the second ignorance. Then within this being, we find the cosmic ignorance, which is what is this becoming, which is really that within which our existence is a part. It is the becoming of one being, and it is one becoming. So this one becoming, what is it? The knowledge of the world as one with us in the consciousness of our true self, thus cancelling our division from it by the separative idea and life of the ego. That is, there is one being of which we are a part and of which we are, that is becoming in this world. Okay. Then the knowledge of our psychic entity and this one becoming of which we are a part and which we are is an eternal becoming. There is no beginning or end to it, and there is no beginning or end to us either. That is our psychic reality. The knowledge of our psychic entity and its immortal persistence in time beyond death and earth existence. And then our psychological sort of infinity, one may say, our psychological many-sidedness and infinity, the knowledge of our greater and inner existence behind the surface. That is the psychological truth or knowledge which overcomes the psychological ignorance. The knowledge of our mind, life and body in its true relation to the self within and the superconscient and spiritual and supramental being above them, the three statuses of the self, that is the immanent, the universal or cosmic being and the transcendent being that we are. We are this person, this triple person, one may say. You know, that is our constitutional ignorance overcome by our constitutional knowledge. The knowledge finally of the true harmony and true use of our thought, will and action. This is the instrumentality, this is the individual becoming and the individual instrument of the becoming. And a change of all our nature into a conscious expression of the truth of the self, the spirit, the divinity, the integral spirit reality. So this is the overcoming of the practical ignorance as a practical knowledge in a divine life. So that ultimately concludes, in a sense, the whole range of the seeking for knowledge and culminates it in what the thesis of this entire study is, the divine life or the life divine.
What is the real difference between clarify a little bit between about the difference between mentality and psychology? I mean, what is the real difference? Is there a difference
between mentality and psychology?
Yes.
I'm trying to see that over there. I will come to that. I'm just trying to see where in the paragraph.
Not exactly in the paragraph. I'm trying to understand the words.
Oh, just in general?
Yes.
Yes. The mentality is the way our mind approaches reality. That is mentality. Mentality is the mode of mental seeking. While psychology, as he's talking about it over here, is the constituents of consciousness within us. And that's why he describes it in terms of the superconscient, subconscient, intraconscient, circumconscient. So what are the various kinds of consciousnesses in general? Okay, we can also talk about mind, life, and matter as forms of consciousness. But he can club these mind, life, and matter into a surface consciousness and an inner consciousness. And then we talk about a circumconscient consciousness, which is the consciousness surrounding us. A consciousness above us, which is the superconscient, and the consciousness below us, which is the subconscious. And the relationship of consciousness, which is the interconscient. So by Sri Aurobindo's use of the term psychology, he's referring to this very complex field of consciousness and the various kinds of consciousness and their relations to each other. While the use of the word mentality would refer to mental consciousness and its operations.
So this use of the word psychology is also as it is used in the Western world, isn't it?
In the Western world, psychology, the term psychology actually comes from the word psyche, which really means soul. But that's why there is a little difficulty with understanding when Sri Aurobindo uses the word psyche, and also when he uses the term psychic being. A lot of people who don't have any background in Sri Aurobindo think he's just talking about various kinds of occult sort of experiences and powers. But the use of the word psychology in the Western sense is the field of the inner life, is the field of the subjective knowledge and how it is constituted. What are the relations of various kinds of subjective consciousness within us? That becomes what Western knowledge calls psychology. So in looking into that, you know, like for example, the word consciousness itself. In the Western idea, the word consciousness usually limits itself to mental consciousness. This is why, you know, as in Keka's question, when we use the term mentality, in some sense, Western normal cognitive science or cognitive philosophy thinks of consciousness as mental consciousness, as the ability to mentalize. Now, to be conscious in that sense. Now, when Sri Aurobindo uses the word consciousness, he's talking about a variety of forms of consciousness which are independent of mind as well as mental consciousness. Now, when we talk about psychology, we are talking about the existence of forms of consciousness that may actually background mind and be different from mind. So, for example, the field of subconscious study or the study of the subconscious is a field of an acknowledge or of the unconscious is the acknowledgement of various operations of consciousness which are different in their logic from the logic of the mind. Okay, we can talk about dream logic, for example, or we can talk about various kinds of components that are interacting in a slippery way to form meanings that are not as clearly defined as the ways in which mind understands meaning. So this is the field of subconscious knowledge. But Sri Aurobindo is saying that subconscious and unconscious knowledge is not the only forms of consciousness available to us in our study of psychology. So modern psychology has introduced the whole idea of transpersonal psychology. Transpersonal psychology means that whatever forms of consciousness are available to us right now, there are forms of transcendence which imply other kinds of holistic or integrated consciousness that have their own reality, maybe an independent reality, a universal objective reality, which we can experience. And how can we experience that? What can we experience? What is the form of experience? That becomes the study of a transpersonal psychology. Now, Sri Aurobindo is saying it goes far beyond that, that we can identify objective forms of consciousness beyond human consciousness, whether above us in the superconscient, below us in the subconscient and unconscious or inconscient, and around us in the circumconscient, in the occult or subliminal or universal consciousness. So all these form the field of a greater psychology, as he terms it in a certain letter of his, which has given the name to A.S. Dalal's book, Towards a Greater Psychology.
The Vashishtha, can you explain what the subliminal is?
Sri Aurobindo uses the term subliminal synonymously with also the term occult, which is below the threshold of our surface consciousness. We may say the inner consciousness, the inner being and its independent consciousness. It constitutes the inner mind, inner vital, inner physical, which have their own kind of consciousness, but which is not limited to the individual. It starts at the individual level, but opens itself out into the universal mind, universal vital, universal physical. And the intraconscient over there is that which connects these. So the subliminal consciousness is the operations of these inner forms of consciousness independently of our surface consciousness.
So it is closer to the Purusha, the mental Purusha, the vital Purusha, and the physical Purusha?
No, this is all the field of Prakriti. These forms of consciousness are all forms of, you may say, mental Prakriti, vital Prakriti, and physical Prakriti. The Purusha is the being itself. And so you may say that is also the root of consciousness. The conscious being in the mind, the conscious being in the vital, the conscious being in the physical, is the mental Purusha, the physical Purusha, or the vital Purusha. But the operations of consciousness, the field of consciousness, is really a study of the prakritic sort of action or forms or modes of being and becoming.
Okay, about the psychology one more time.
Yes.
Is it the entire reflection of knowledge in all our layers?
Psychology, by what he means by psychology?
Yes.
Yes, the psychological ignorance, as he calls it, or psychological knowledge would be the entire, why I'm saying it is the field of Prakriti, the universal and individual, all the various, as you're saying, the interpenetrating kinds of consciousnesses or the prakritic field is that, because that's what, because you can relate it to the constitutional field where the purushas are involved. The constitutional field is who is the person in whom all these consciousnesses are present. This person is the purusha, ultimately the supramental purusha, then subsidiary to it, the cosmic purusha, and then projected from that, the psychic purusha. But these purushas, and also you may say the mental purusha, vital purusha, and physical purusha as triple formulations of these root purushas. But what kind of consciousness forms the field of the prakritic experience? That is this entire field of all the forms of experience available to us as beings or as the being.
So these two paragraphs go in tandem, right? The previous one where he's talking of the seven ignorances, and this one where he's showing a way to resolve them.
Yes.
Yeah, and these were very dense paragraphs. Shall we read the last paragraph of the chapter?
Yes.
Kika, you want to read?
Knowledge which can be learned and completed in our present mold of consciousness. It must be an experience, a becoming, a change of consciousness, a change of being. This brings in the evolutionary character. This brings in the evolutionary character of the becoming and the fact that our mental ignorance is only a stage in our evolution. The integral knowledge then can only come by an evolution of our being and our nature. And that would seem to signify a slow process in time, such as has accompanied the other evolutionary transformations. But as against that inference, there is the fact that the evolution has now become conscious, and its method and steps need not be altogether of the same character as when it was subconscious in its process. The integral knowledge, since it must result from a change of consciousness, can be gained by a process in which our will and endeavor have a part, in which they can discover and apply their own steps and method. its growth in us can proceed by conscious self-transformation. It is necessary then to see what is likely to be the principle of this new process of evolution, and what are the movements of the integral knowledge that must necessarily emerge in it. Or, in other words, what is the nature of the consciousness that must be the base of our life divine, and how that life may be expected to be formed or to form itself, to materialize, or, as one might say, to realize.
So here, Sri Aurobindo is pointing out that one of the things about our understanding of knowledge, you know, just as we just in our last discussion, you know, the whole idea about consciousness, there is a sense that consciousness is predominantly mental consciousness in us. So there is a kind of feeling or experience that human beings are mental beings that determines or lends its own color to our understanding of the meaning of the word knowledge itself. So knowledge often becomes for us an intellectual process, an arrival at a knowing which is an objective knowing, a knowing of some object which is outside of us and that can be actually understood in the intellectual sense. But the reason he has gone through this entire chapter in trying to bring us into contact with what he calls an integral knowledge is exactly this fact that the field of knowledge is not constrained by mind. That this what we take to be knowledge through mind, intellectual knowledge, is a limitation of mentality. It's a problem of mental ignorance. So we may say all these sevenfold ignorance is really in a sense a problem of mental ignorance. The fact that mental consciousness also in its essence is involved in the formation of the sevenfold ignorance. But also mental consciousness in its descent from whatever we may call the self of mind to whatever operations are present in the human mind have determined the descent of these forms of ignorance that he has talked about. Now, ultimately, these forms of ignorance are constrained and are a problem of mental ignorance. So, what we understand by knowledge itself needs revising. And what are the forms of knowledge also need revising. And this revision cannot come without a certain change of consciousness, without a movement to another kind of consciousness, even within our present condition, other roots of consciousness. And then from these roots of consciousness, a growth into another status of consciousness. And so that's why he says it must be an experience, a becoming, a change of consciousness, a change of being. So here both in terms of what we are moving into something else, and as a result, a change of being, a change of what we are. So that is the only way in which we can arrive at the overcoming of this field of sevenfold ignorance. So that's how Sri Aurobindo now brings in the idea of the evolutionary character of the becoming. And seeking for knowledge is ultimately a cosmic seeking. It is not a seeking for self-knowledge, is not the seeking of individual monads, but the seeking of the self. And as a seeking of the self, it is the root of an evolutionary process, because this is the becoming. The becoming is a becoming of self-knowledge. So he points it out in that way. This is brings in the evolutionary character of the becoming and the fact that our mental ignorance is only a stage in our evolution. So here now, he situates our present consciousness, our present understanding of knowledge, our present ignorance within this cosmic evolution. The integral knowledge then can only come by an evolution of our being and our nature. And this is Sri Aurobindo's major contribution, even in the field of Indian yoga. Because up until now, the solution to the problem of ignorance had been sought in an individual way. And it was considered, this is one of the very major sort of, you know, I mean, you may say, steps or differences that Sri Aurobindo represents in the field of Indian darshan philosophy, which is that all these darshanas that had developed in the intellectual cycle of Indian philosophy considered a very trenchant divide between what may be called knowledge and ignorance. That is, the field of ignorance was seen as eternal and the field of knowledge was seen as eternal. Sri Aurobindo is contesting that and pointing to the field of ignorance as being a temporal field constrained temporally. It is only a temporality. Ignorance is a temporality. Knowledge is an eternity and a perpetuity. In other words, it is statically eternal and temporally continues forever. But ignorance is really a temporality. This is the evolutionary condition of the ignorance as a becoming. Becoming will go on forever, but within it, mental ignorance is situated as a form of time, and therefore it will be overpassed. So that's the point he's making over here. It's an evolutionary step. But if we compare this evolutionary step to other evolutions that have gone before, then we find that we might expect this to be a very slow evolution. The integral knowledge then can only come by an evolution of our being and our nature. That would seem to signify a slow process in time, such as has accompanied other evolutionary transformations. And so these transformations have come through some processes, whether we see them as accidental or whether we see them as partially conscious or subconscious within nature, within the ignorance of nature, of Prakriti. So if we are to suppose that human beings are also products of Prakriti, then we can expect that similar kinds of quasi-accidental or quasi-conscious or subconscious processes will ultimately evolve forms of knowledge that transcend or surpass mental ignorance. But here he is introducing his other sort of idea, which is that against that inference, there is the fact that the evolution has now become conscious. And its method and steps need not be altogether of the same character as when it was subconscious in its process. The human beings have a sense of consciousness, even in its most primordial way, even if we think of it as a mental consciousness. Our first sense of ourselves is as conscious beings. Then we may seek for the root of consciousness. But the fact of being conscious is a self-evident self-definition of the human. Now, this sense of being conscious already introduces into the processes of nature a kind of quickening. A quickening that can actually tamper with the process of nature. Science itself is a tampering of this kind, a bold acknowledgement of the fact that we have in us some property by which we can create a better world than that which God has given us. So similarly, we can turn the root of consciousness upon our own evolution if we can find that root of consciousness. And we need not be constrained to the automatic processes of subconscious nature. So that is what he is bringing up. So firstly, the idea of an evolution. Secondly, the idea of a conscious evolution. And thirdly, the idea of an integral evolution. That its growth in us can proceed by a conscious self-transformation. It is necessary then to see what is likely to be the principle of this new process of evolution. And what are the movements of the integral knowledge that must necessarily emerge in it? So that needs to be our study. What is the kind of consciousness that we are talking about in this intervention of consciousness in nature's process? And what are the various movements of an integral knowledge that must emerge in this consciousness? And so again, he relates this, connects this up to what we were discussing last time as the very aim and objective. You see, this is one of the marks of what one might call a universal teacher. Whether you call it an avatar or not is another matter, but the mark or the sign of the preserver with a capital P, which is that there is a kind of seeing of the root problem of existence as the becoming. You say the Buddha starts with that kind of a root problem, that there is suffering to our experience. And how are we going to overcome this suffering? Similarly, Sri Aurobindo's root problem is not so much how are we going to escape from this world, or how are we going to arrive at an abstract knowledge, or how are some people going to experience bliss, but what he points out at the end of that previous paragraph, this is the root problem, what he calls the practical ignorance. I'm going to read that again because it's so central, and even in a meditation, to actually hold that, because that becomes the spring of aspiration. And that is, we are ignorant in our thought, will, sensations, actions, return wrong or imperfect responses at every point to the questionings of the world, wander in a maze of errors and desires, strivings and failures, pain and pleasure, sin and stumbling, follow a crooked road, grope blindly for a changing goal. These are the roots of our experience. And the roots of experience are what are limited or human experience are what we need to find a solution to in the knowledge. This is the integral knowledge. So the integral knowledge would be one in which we will arrive at what could be called the divine life or the life divine. Now, this is one way of looking at it. But the other way of looking at that idea of the movements of the integral knowledge that must necessarily emerge in it is to think of it also not merely as an evolution, but a descent, avataran. That the evolution, as Sri Aurobindo sees it, is also an emergence, not only from below, but from above, through the pressure of that which is trying to know itself in the field of knowledge. So that descent of the supermind is another way by which this whole emergence of integral knowledge is to be understood. And consciousness, in its groping and in its attempt to find its own root, must arrive at some kind of a union, yoga, with that descending consciousness. In a sense, that is the life divine that gives us the true and integral knowledge, completes this field of reality. And that's why he ends it so beautifully by saying that what is the nature of the consciousness that must be the base of the life divine, and how that life may be expected to be formed or to form itself, to materialize, or as one might say, to realize. In other words, to become real, to manifest its reality.
It sounds like the invocation of Paraprakriti. Is that so?
Sounds like what? Come again?
Invocation of Paraprakriti.
Yes. Yes. This is like an invocation to Paraprakriti. Paraprakriti as the descending Shakti, as that which will emerge as the consciousness, absolutely, of the integral being. Movements of the integral knowledge. Life divine is a very interesting study because, in a sense, as somebody was pointing out in some of our other discussions on science, culture, and integral yoga, Sri Aurobindo does not use many of the words he uses in his other literature. For example, the mother is not used as such. The term the mother is used very rarely and not in its metaphysical sense as in the book The Mother. Nor does he use the term the avatar anywhere in this book. Yet if we look under the surface, we will find that the mother is being invoked throughout the book. But we have to find it. Point is, he's entering into the field, the public field of world philosophy. And in that public field, it is necessary to address whatever actually exists there and to create the language through which that can be illuminated. But within that, there may be other depths, that other words that have not actually been given their name, but that name he has given elsewhere. So yes, that is, in a sense, this last paragraph is talking about the yoga as the yoga of the emergence of consciousness within us under the pressure of the descending supramental Shakti and an invocation to the Paraprakriti, or we may say to the mother.
See, I was reading this chapter 14, Supermind as Creator.
Yes.
And there, the concept that you were talking of, comprehension and apprehension, those
yes.
are described pretty well.
Yes.
And there's some others also that we touched upon about the supermind being in between, the force, the power in between. All those things are very well explained. If people want to go back and read that chapter 14, it's going to be a great help for this chapter.
Yes, it is true in a sense. Actually, it's true that reading book 1 is the true background to reading these chapters, and particularly those chapters on the supermind in book 1, which actually begin from chapter 13 and go until chapter 18. Those chapters are all on the supermind, and in a sense they illuminate everything that Sri Aurobindo is going to say afterwards, but also the whole of book 1 that moves all the way from the, you know, introduces man in the universe, the ego and the dualities, and goes all the way from Sat down to matter, including all the realms of supermind and the various operations of supermind in 5 chapters, is really very, very useful to understand whatever we are studying. But this is another approach. This part of book 2, part 2, is another philosophical approach to the whole issue of reality. It can be studied in and by itself, but of course it's illuminated more by those particular chapters.
That last word that you put in quote, the realize, did he
yes.
pun on it? Like one is, as you said, real, to make real. And did he also try to say that it's realization?
Yes, no doubt. This whole paragraph actually has that double sense to it, that it is a becoming of something above as well as a becoming of something below, that it is both at once. We realize the integral knowledge, and the integral knowledge becomes real in us and thus realizes itself.
Oh, so there's actually 3 meanings to the realize. The last realize is, as they use in French, I think, as in reach its fruition.
Yes. Because the integral knowledge is a Shakti. The integral knowledge is the Shakti of the integral being. And it's a knowledge will. It is Paraprakriti. Therefore, that is becoming. Integral knowledge it is that is realizing itself. So as I said, the whole thing is about self-knowledge seen from both sides. This is the double evolution. We are evolving towards the integral knowledge. The integral knowledge is realizing itself in us.
So this gives us a lot of material to ponder over. And we have also come up to around 9:25. So shall we end with a meditation?
Yes.